Greg, good morning.
G'day, Doug. How are you?
Good.
Good. Thanks so much for making the time to do this. I really appreciate it.
Well, so where are you?
I'm actually at good on Coogee.
Are
you Coogee? Coogee, yeah, mate. I've been all over the place. I was at, well, I normally live at Maroogra, but I've got a mate of mine has a bit of a sound studio set up at Coogee.
Yeah.
The media game, and I was at Balmain this morning, so I've been everywhere in preparation for this. And I was watching on the Fox this morning as well.
Oh, yeah, having a few laughs.
Yeah, mate, yeah. So anyway, so we'll swing into it and get some sort of interview.
No worries.
All right, fantastic. So I've got a whole lot of questions here. All right, so let's go with it. Now, how did you get your break, Doug?
A big break.
Yeah.
I had been in Europe. I was travelling around doing the Great Australian Trek.
Yeah.
In the back of a common van.
Oh, yeah.
In a bummer, I was driving in the back when I was sleeping.
Yeah.
And came back without much idea of what I wanted to do with my life. I was in my early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up being a retail salesperson after being expelled from school. Australia's worst student. And I sent back tapes because I didn't have very good handwriting. My father, who was a lawyer, used to send my letters back with red lines through the misspelled words and mark it out of 100. So I sent him tapes back because I couldn't stand that level of abuse anymore, and he played them to a few friends who were in the industry, advertising, radio industry, and they said, Doug's pretty articulate, he's reasonably eloquent, has he ever thought of a career in broadcasting? And my father said this to me, and it's the first time it had occurred to me.
Fantastic.
And within a week of the comment, the broadcasting suggestion, I heard an ad for a radio school, the Digger May Radio School,
right,
on 2SM back in the mid-70s.
Well,
so I thought, oh, that's fate.
Yep.
The windows opened.
Mm-hmm.
So I rang them up and went and did the audition.
Yep.
And they said, congratulations, you're good enough to do the course. I later discovered that the people in there were speech impediments. Being good enough to do the course meant you had to have $300.
Yeah, yep.
But that was me, and they did some audition tapes, and I got a gig at 280 Armidale.
And it sort of reminds me of some of my small amount of involvement with community TV and community radio in Sydney.
Yeah, it'd be the same thing.
Yeah, he's got money to pay the membership free, and can you come in on a Saturday, and all of a sudden an opportunity opens up.
Hello, I'm a broadcast.
That's right, you've got to be there, and yeah, someone doesn't turn up for work, and it's sort of cutthroat at times, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Yeah, so tell me, what are you most well known for?
Oh, I'm a big sack. Like Jerry Packer.
Quite a distinction.
There's a lot of misunderstanding about it because it was only ever to be one program.
What?
It wasn't meant to be a series. They did intend that it ran all the way through, though, I've got to admit.
Okay.
And it was ratified by the Channel 9 censors before it went to air and by the Australian Broadcasting Tribunal. The last decision they made before they became the Australian Broadcasting Authority, they all agreed it was innocuous, and moreover, it was rating 36s when Mr. Packer took the show off the air, which made it the highest rating show of the year, I think second highest behind Elle Macpherson's swimsuit special.
Whoa!
But certainly, that made me a household name in states. Never heard of Doug Mulroney before.
Well, that's what they say. Sometimes in the broadcasting industry, you know you haven't really made it until you've been sacked one or two times, and your name ends up in all the papers, and you know, the mugshots are out wherever.
I remember Paul Daddy rang me afterwards.
What?
They were doing a production of the Rocky Horror Show.
Oh, yes.
In Sydney at the Theatre Royal, and he said, mate, I want you to be the narrator.
Oh, wow.
And I said, look, I haven't done much stage work, and I don't really have time because I'm doing the radio thing, and that's, you know, I only start 5 days a week, and I don't want to do 8 shows and a Saturday matinee.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got to do it, you've got to do it, I'll pay you a lot of money. I said, why would you do that? He said, this press that's been generated by Kerry Packer thanking you,
yeah,
it's got to be worth about $2 million. It would be a fantastic profile,
yeah,
for somebody doing the show. I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but I guess it is a reminder of the old adage that there's no such thing as bad publicity.
Well, that's why I remember one time I didn't realise I was starting to just get involved in the media business a little bit at the time, but I called up, can I mention the radio station?
Yeah.
I called up 2UE at the time, and I was doing some Olympic volunteer work in the technology section, and I called up John Laws just to talk about reality TV, but it happened Bob Mansfield from Telstra was on before, and I just said, oh, you know, it's nice man, smart man, da-da-da. And all of a sudden I get quoted that, you know, Greg says he prefers Telstra over Optus in the newspaper because I've worked for both companies. But what the media section of the Australian failed to realise was the fact that it actually worked for both companies and actually mainly caught up to discuss reality TV. But I guess that's the media for us, isn't it?
Yeah, they'll pick what they want.
They certainly do, and they do it time and time again. So, Tommy, how did the Basement deal come about, Doug?
Well, I had a vision after retiring from radio the first time in Triple M. I had a vibe on creating a studio that would create product that would be viable on radio and television simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
It came about after doing an interview with Kerri-Ann Kennelly and one of her cohorts, Gordon Elliott, I think.
All right, yep.
So they were in the studio at Channel 10, sitting on the obligatory leather lounge with the two potted palms.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the Triple M studio, whipping carts in and out and sound effects, and it was all kind of frenetic and attempting in the middle of all that chaos to talk to them about something. I can't even remember what the issue was, but I think we'd had a number one survey or something and they wanted to do the interview, and Hamish Cameron, who's now my CEO, was the director of the radio end, the stuff that was being beamed from the Triple M studio back to Channel 10.
Mm-hmm.
And he rang me up and said, "Oh, we're going to tape this interview." And we sort of sat down over a couple of beers and looked at a videotape of the interview, and it was quite astonishing to cross from the radio studio to the television studio and back again and notice, and I mean no disrespect to Kerri-Ann or to Gordon Elliott, but just the difference in energy levels. You know, the radio studio was pumping, it was a real environment, scaled for real people, whereas television, as it invariably is, was a big studio with lots of lights and a sort of bogus set.
Yes.
And Hamish and I talked about that length and thought people would watch, if you could bring some production values to it, people would watch a show that emanated from a radio studio.
Well, so you're sort of saying, well, you can't really manufacture the energy levels or the atmosphere of places that have either got it happening or not.
Yeah, I'm saying that.
Yeah.
It has to do, to some extent, with the scale of a radio studio and the fact that the radio disc jockey is hands-on. He's making the show, not just the talking head, but putting it together.
Yeah.
And there's a vibe about that, an energy about that, that adds very significant interest to the viewer.
Yeah.
So our flash was that we could bring some cameras to bear. Probably you'd have to build a purpose-built studio, a slightly larger studio, but maintain the ambiance of a radio studio, the energy of a radio studio, and make a television program that would work simultaneously on radio.
Oh.
Now, at that time, the internet wasn't discussed, and moreover, there was no technology that would allow you to store the vision. We needed something that would spit out vision, just like you spat out audio in a radio studio, so that you could generate both streams simultaneously.
Yes.
Now, over a period of years, of course, technology burgeoned, and we were able to conjure a studio where you could play DVDs, which didn't exist when we had the idea originally, instead of tapes, and that those DVDs were as easy to manage and to store as CDs, so there was no longer anything precluding the building of a studio that would be able to manufacture television and radio simultaneously. And moreover, by that time, we not only had the internet up and functioning, which was a big part of a lot of people's lives, 50% of Australian homes utilised it at that time.
Yes.
But broadband was coming, which meant that the vision would not only be 8 sort of static pictures a second, but you would get, like serious frames.
Yeah.
A 26 frames a second frame rate, which would give you a television quality picture.
Telstra and Chief came along to the party and supported yourselves? Did it work something like that?
Well, it was actually ARN originally, because we shopped the idea around. We ended up negotiating with Triple M and the Australian Radio Network, and the Australian Radio Network, who owned 2WS, actually offered to build me, but apart from matching the Triple M money, would build me a purpose-built studio, which Triple M wouldn't do.
Right.
Very committed to the idea, so we built a studio that would handle television pictures, which we disseminated to Foxtel, and radio, which we disseminated to 2WS, and then Telstra was so excited, just with broadband beginning to grow, that they wanted a part of the action as well. When we fell foul of the Australian Radio Network management, we just couldn't see eye to eye on programming.
Yep.
Telstra came in and said, "Look, we don't want this to go away just because you're fighting with your your radio host will sponsor it and develop it for broadband, which they did, and that was back in like 1998, 1999, and then we've just grown into the internet from that point.
Mm.
So that we're now effectively sponsored by Telstra, and we have an audience of 840,000, I think originally it was like 5,000 internet viewers, and now we've got 840,000 streams a month globally.
Yeah, no.
And obviously about 200,000 people connected to broadband at the moment. We regularly service 100,000, so one in two Australian broadband viewers is not bad.
Nice, it's massive.
And we've migrated it to Music Max so that we can use cable television as a vehicle to promote the broadband.
Right.
Which is our primary focus.
That's, well, you can't go anywhere without seeing the website address mentioned everywhere, and then you've got the email regular send-outs to supplement it, so it's, you can't go anywhere without seeing it.
No, it's working pretty well.
Yeah.
What we had to do, the only other part I haven't mentioned, is that we needed an umbrella. I think we started out originally as Mole AFM.
Right.
But given that we wanted to go 24-7 and we wanted to have other jocks working here,
yeah,
it was a bit onerous for them to work under my name, so we needed an umbrella.
Yeah.
And fortuitously, we saw an article in the paper that the basement, one of the chairs in the basement nightclub was up for sale, and we looked at each other and said, that's got to be a fantastic name for a broadcast entity. And when we talked to the boys, it turned out that they were pretty interested in having their performances webcast. So we did a licensing deal with the basement so that we have rights to the basement name and indeed to everything that happens on the stage are permitting. So that's the convoluted history of how the basement.com, so that you are indeed the basement.tv, as we're calling it now, came into being.
Jesus, quite a lot involved. It certainly, as I said, nothing, anything but an overnight success.
Oh, yeah, no, it's been a very protracted process. And in real terms, everybody who works here, you know, is probably working for less than they could earn elsewhere in the industry, but they're all deeply committed to the idea, which is exciting. It's reminiscent of the early days of FM. You know, not a lot of people are across the technology yet, but it's pretty obvious that those who've got it love it, and it's going to grow.
Huge. And on that point, tell me, how do you motivate your staff, and are you a good boss? I had to throw that in, mate.
I don't have to motivate my staff. They're pretty excited to be here.
I'm sure they are.
There are freedoms at thebasement.tv that don't exist in commercial radio, or indeed on the ABC. We play a mix of music that you would never be able to play in commercial radio, and I think that, given that most of my staff are music lovers, is a serious motivation. They really love coming to work because they get to do a thing they couldn't do anywhere else. It's a unique opportunity.
Yeah.
And how do I motivate them? I motivate them with my passion, I think.
Mm. It's contagious. Tell me, have you done much work in Melbourne? What do you say the main difference between Melbourne and Sydney Schumer is?
I did 12 months in Melbourne in 1978 at 3AW.
Oh, right.
Which was kind of talk. So it was the early days of my career, and I was a serious young broadcaster who advised menopausal women on how to overcome the distress of leaving their handbag on the train.
Oh, yeah.
Was there a difference between the two cities? Well, it was for me, because I'd gone from working in rock and roll radio to talks radio, and as you know, the radio station one works for has an enormous impact on the way you view the town.
Mm.
So I was with a very straight and reactionary radio station in Melbourne, and that impacted on my view of the city. I've changed my mind. I mean, once I got away from the oppressive nature of 3AW and got to experience Melbourne as a tourist and a media head who went down for functions, I fell in love with it. I think Melbourne's a great town.
Cool.
Do they have a different attitude? I don't know that they have a different attitude. They certainly have a different social pattern. You know, they embrace music more enthusiastically than the Sydney audience.
Mm. Well, the clubs and the cafes and the live sporting events, they seem to come out in droves for those sort of
things. It's that. They're more active. You know, we tend to sort of sit on our dates. You know, there's more of a cash potato syndrome in Sydney. But I mean, to give you an example, when we broadcast basement music shows on a Tuesday night on the ABC, we get a bigger audience in Melbourne than we do in Sydney.
Well,
I can't remember But I mean, you know, sometimes as many as 90,000-95,000 viewers in Melbourne at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday night on the ABC, and, you know, probably never more than about 65,000 in Sydney. So, you know, it's demonstrably more music-oriented. As for humour, I don't know. I mean, there's a big push that suggests that all humour comes out of Melbourne. I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I think they, again, have more live venues. They have the Melbourne Comedy Festival. It's more overt. It's more in your face.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, you've got to have a sense of humour to live in Sydney. Look at the traffic.
Oh, mate, you know, I'm actually been thinking of getting out of here. Maybe 200 or 500 kilometres north of Sydney at some point down the track will probably do me a lot of good.
I think a lot of people feel exactly like you.
Yeah, they're going up there in droves. Tell me, mate, how did you develop your wicked sense of humour?
I don't know. I mean, it probably is. That's a problem. I won't argue.
So was it a lot of experiences, or was it being around different people, just a whole lot of things, and giving up telling me all influenced and something inspired? And
I didn't seek to become a humorist. I mean, I don't describe myself as a comedian. I mean, I'm a broadcaster who does jokes.
Yeah.
You know, it's family. I guess my mum and dad were always doing gags. There was, you know, a plethora of weird uncles with, you know, the ability to do straight jack flips.
That's almost an eclectic environment.
It came from that bit of nurture and probably genetically as a bit of nature.
Right.
I know, you know, obviously influences, you know, it's all very well beside influences like, you know, the Goons and Python and Dudley Moore and Peter Cook and people like that, but the truth of the matter is, you wouldn't go to those things if you didn't have a passion for humour anyway, so that's got to be sort of innate, I think.
I guess we all are what we are, and you go out and you get a platform, and all of a sudden everyone else can say, oh, this is what Doug's like, and tell me, mate, do you prefer TV or radio broadcasting?
I much prefer radio.
Okay.
I think radio's fantastic. I mean, with a head like mine, television's an imposition. But the thing I don't like is live audiences.
Okay.
So I'm not averse to doing television.
Why is that? Why aren't you into live audiences?
Well, I'm not particularly confident, you know. I don't have that confidence that tells me I deserve to be there and that I own the space. But that isn't an issue when you're in a radio studio, or indeed a television studio with no live audience, because you're only sort of effectively working for the benefit of your colleagues.
Yes.
And if you have a good relationship with them, it can be a nice sort of club atmosphere.
Yeah. I saw you on Beauty and the Beast going back about a year or two ago, and my girlfriend felt that you were the first beast not to be, in her words, a misogynist, which means woman hater. I mean, do you like working with women?
Well, I did. I thought I did Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, really?
And that's why I had to stop doing it. I was going out to play with the other team. Look, I think you're right. I think you're quite right. I said to them before I went and did the show, which I only effectively did to promote The Basement. I said to Brian Walsh, who suggested it to me, that I would do it, you know, if I could ruthlessly mention thebasement.com.au and bring two of the girls that work for me to the team.
Yep.
So that we could pump up the volume on the website. And he conceded the point. But I did say before going there, you know, I think you've got a problem in that the show depends on the beast being a misogynist. And I like women. And I think that it worked the other way. A lot of those women are still friends of mine. I had lunch with Dr. Penny on Sunday, this past Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
She came over with her family, and she was saying, you know, one of the difficulties I had as a beauty on the show was that, you know, you would come out as the voice of infinite reason, and I'd sit there thinking, God, I agree with you. And it doesn't make for very stimulating television.
No, there's a bit more confrontational, perhaps a sort of PUE or 2GB approach or something.
I mean, I can see the point, you know, straight up. But also, you know, watching some of the more vitriolic ladies club each other and tear each other to pieces, I found, you know, very disturbing. I mean, ultimately, I don't live my life in a confrontational manner. I like to sort of see peace and order and a few laughs. So I wasn't enjoying it. I mean, I did the 12 months I agreed to do and then said no more.
Yeah. No, I think your warmness came through on the TV as well, and I think that's one reason I think, I mean, just for me being a viewer and, you know, audience as well, is you just go, oh, no, I like watching this bloke, and you're sort of not trying to antagonise or get people to call in to get to pile off or anything. It's just sort of a nice feeling, a good vibe going through the place.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think it impacted on ratings. I mean, the show rated 4s and 5s when Stan did it, and it rated 4s and 5s when I did it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it made much difference, but there was certainly a big change in attitude to the program.
Yeah.
And the best example of that, I think, was when they did the Beauty for a Day competition, where women were asked to send tapes in to be a part of the program for one recording session.
Mm-hmm.
I think the year before, when Stan had done the show, they got 45 entries, and the year we did it, we got over 400. So,
wow.
But there was a feeling people were more comfortable with the program.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't necessarily make it any more popular. I mean, a lot of blokes want to see some man thrashing girls, you know.
Yeah. What's your views on syndication in both the TV and radio business?
In what sense?
Well, I mean, syndication, I guess they can broadcast out to a greater audience for less money, but when they start doing that, sometimes you lose the local feel of a station.
Oh, okay, so at that level, I mean, my main hostility to syndication is the lack of jobs and opportunities for broadcasters. I mean, certainly, I think if you're living in a small town, your radio station becomes infinitely less relevant because you're getting a cotted-up format that was designed for any market. Just, you know, insert call sign here. So, yeah, there's less of a service to the listener, or indeed in television to the viewer, but more importantly, you know, as a broadcaster, I resent the fact that dedication to the bottom line, you know, radio networks run by lawyers and accountants rather than by broadcasters means that you've got fewer opportunities for people who sit in the studios and make the magic.
Certainly do. What advice do you have for others looking to become successful in the broadcasting and media business?
Be preposterous.
Meaning,
just out there, or determined?
So.
If you find that, in fact, be preposterous regardless of what you do, because ultimately, most of us are pretty dull.
Yes.
And, you know, and listening back to this interview will probably depress me, because, you know, I'm speaking without a form of energy, just sharing a few ideas with you, and that tends to leave one looking relatively tedious. Well, I never wanted to be an executive. The fact that I turned out to be the chairman of the board here at Chief Entertainment kind of amuses me. I did it by default. But I never wanted to be a program director or a radio station manager. Had I ever done that for a living,
right.
The first thing I'd have done, I think if I walked into a new radio station, would have been to convene a jocks meeting.
Right.
And before everybody placed a microphone, a tape recorder under the table and left everybody to chat one to the other for 15, 20 minutes, keep them waiting, and then go into the meeting and pull the tape recorder out and hopefully you wouldn't hear too much ill of yourself or it could create embarrassment. Or you wouldn't find out that one of the jocks was having sex with your wife. But the object of the exercise was to then replay the tape and then these guys, that's how you sound. That's your level of communication. That's the energy you put into a dialogue. And you're going to have to do a lot better than that when you're on the radio. You're going to have to lift it up. Electronic media, I mean, even, you know, in the case of ABC News, is ultimately about entertainment rather than the dissemination of information. And you've got to pump up the volume.
Yes.
And no matter how big you think you are, you're probably not too big.
Nah. Have you said that? What word best describes you, huh? If you had to choose one word.
Overweight.
Oh, no, come on, another, maybe something in the more, I don't know, media sense, or media sense or humour sense, come on, what's another word would you say?
Well, I never go for all that. What's your favourite song, give me one word for, I mean,
just a whole lot of...
It's a journalistic technique that I don't necessarily regard with a great deal of respect.
Yeah.
One word, how can anyone say verbose?
You're right. There we go. Verbose. There you are. I love it.
Verbose.
Yeah. And finally, in say 50 years from now, how would you like to be remembered?
I'm at that age where I should start thinking about how I'll be remembered. I never worried about it much before. But if there's a legacy, I think I'd like to be remembered as somebody who encouraged talent and wasn't afraid of or threatened by new talent. Was happy to embrace it and then release it, set it free.
Yes.
And certainly technically, I'd like to be remembered as somebody who believed in new technologies and embraced them and sponsored and promoted them.
Mm. It's been an amazing career and it's certainly not over yet.
You're right.
I'm thinking millions of people have the same view, I'm sure.
You're very kind.
Well, thanks. Any final thoughts? We've covered a whole lot of ground today, haven't we?
Yeah, well, just looking at us.
We have.
Time's money. I'll have to send you
a mate, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you, Doug. I really appreciate it.
Not at all.
And I hope to see you around the traps. And all the best with your ongoing success.
I appreciate it. Good luck with your career.
Thanks, mate.
And my regards to your girlfriend. She's a woman of infinite taste.
You're fine as always.
She likes us both. She can't be bad.
That's right. She's all good. Thanks, Doug. I'll catch up with you down the track a bit.
I hope so.
All right. Speak to you soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.